Thanks very much for the invitation to come here. I did this morning with Steve Kivelson the usual tool of remembering the place that I lived in 25 years ago for a couple of years. Nothing changed. Okay.
We changed.
Yeah. We said that, but I'm not going. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about care effect on some unconventional superconductor. Except that I thought that I'm really going to squeeze everything else and spend. Sorry. I have to stop and change the screen because the instrument here chose the wrong screen. Should be okay now. So I'm going to concentrate really on yttrium barium copper oxide and the peculiarities of care effect in this material. Although, as you can see, there's a whole variety of superconductors and superconducting structures that we studied. And if I have time, I may tell you a little bit about maybe praseodymium, osmium, antimony, or uranium, ruthenium, to silicon, to both heavy fermion superconductors. Or even what I find very interesting now is the superconductor ferromagnet proximity structures that the technique I'm going to briefly tell you about can really tell a lot. That's kind of an outline. I have, in order to come and tell you about the pseudo-gap state in yttrium barium copper oxide, I need to tell you a little bit about how we measure, what we measure, our sensitivity, etc. And I'm going to do that through these two systems, but it's really going to be very, very brief. To remind you, time reverse asymmetry, it's the operation that takes T to minus T, and you look how this affects your system. You apply T, the time reversal operator, on a wave function. If spin consideration is not included, then you simply take the complex conjugate. If spin consideration, if spin rotation is included, then, for example, a ferromagnet will go from spin up to spin down. For me, the easiest way to see it is simply looking at the magnetization or the moment as current, and current, of course, changes sign under time reversal operation. The reason I'm showing that is you'll see in a minute. Search for broken time reversal symmetry, at least for me, started the very early days of HITC when there was a proposal for anion superconductivity as the mechanism for high temperature superconductivity. At that time, there were proposals for several types of experiments. Optical experiments were one type of experiments, muon spin rotation and others. At that time, we invented the technique I'm going to talk about for optical, for measurement of optical properties. This turned to be wrong, hypothesis of anion superconductivity. However, there were other possibilities for time reversal symmetry breaking effects in high TC. There were proposals for a complex order parameter, which of course will be chiral and generate time reversal symmetry breaking effects. There were flux states, either they do or do not break translation symmetry, those break time reversal symmetry. And this was all fine. People looked at these from a variety of techniques. I'm going to come back, in fact, to these later when I talk to ITC. However, at least for us, the revival of the field, which means go and test for time reversal symmetry breaking effects at the very very high sensitivity, was when strontium ruthenate was superconductivity was discovered in strontium ruthenate, and later on. Time reversal, it was proposed that it's a superconductor with p-wave symmetry and it breaks time reversal symmetry. Following that, there were lots of other materials that people looked at. So I'm gonna actually go in reverse order and tell you a little bit about our investigations. But before that, I need to kind of make the connection between magneto-optics, which is the techniques that that we are using, and time reversal symmetry breaking. So to remind you, the magneto-optics basically result in the difference between the indices of refraction for light that interact with matter for right and left circularly polarized light. If you take a material and it's magnetized, then the two eigenstates for light in the material are the two circular polarizations, which are the same as the two spin of the photons, and they distinguish between transitions that are separated by I don't have a, is there any pointer?
Yeah, it should be.
Cocker spaniel, any? Oh. Transition that are separated by quantity one of spin, which is the difference in the two types of photons, which also is the difference between right and left circularly polarized lights. The two most common magneto-optic effects are the Faraday effect, in which you take linearly polarized light, you go through the material, and you find that there is rotation of polarization. And of course, since linearly polarized light is made out of the two circular polarizations, and these two have different indices of refraction, there's going to be a difference as the light goes through the material, and the end result is a rotation by amount of Faraday angle. Similarly, for the polar Kerr effect, it's the same thing, but rather in reflection. Assume this is normal incident reflection, so light is basically going to be reflected and polarization will be rotated by the amount theta k. So plane wave and time reversal symmetry, this is going to come when I discuss the way we measure. So as we said, you apply the time reversal operator, t goes to minus t, and for simple plane waves, it simply means that you take the complex conjugate of your wave, which means that light that goes to the right, if you apply time reversal symmetry, is light that comes from the left. This sounds trivial, but it also tells you what one wants to do in order to test for time reversal symmetry breaking. One wants to compare these two incoming and outgoing waves. If you look at where time reversal symmetry breaking effects come into the properties of materials, if time reversal symmetry is broken, then measuring the complex dielectric function, or if you want the conductivity, just simply multiply by I omega, you acquire off-diagonal terms, okay? And if you measure at a particular frequency, these are off-diagonal terms measured at a particular frequency, the conductivity has real and imaginary part, and if you want now to consider the conductivity with respect to the two indices of refraction for right and left circularly polarized light, you remember that the index of refraction is given as the square root of the dielectric function. So the electric function is the square of the index of refraction. For the electric function for right and left circularly polarized light is the index of refraction. This tilde is simply for the full index of refraction, both real and imaginary part, because usually people use n for real part and K or kappa for the imaginary part of the index of refraction. So that's N plus IK for both right and left circularly polarized square. You write it in terms of the conductivity rather than the dielectric function, and then you can invert it and find what's the relation between the conductivities and the indices of refraction. Now, the Faraday angle is given by the real part of the difference between right and left, the index of refraction for right and left circularly polarized light, multiplied by omega over the speed of light, which is basically, you have the K number there, and the distance the beam goes inside the material. In reflection, there is a little bit more complicated combination of this difference between left and right circularly polarized light divided by this combination, and you take the imaginary part. Now, that's to take the Faraday and Kerr angles. Now, as we remember, real and imaginary, the indices of refraction have real and imaginary part, and the conductivities have real and imaginary part. And you can go from here, for example, that's the easiest to calculate the Faraday angle, and you find that the dependence on the conductivity is given in terms of the dependence on the real and imaginary parts of the conductivity. N and K, if there is no subscript of right or left, will be for the material with, if you want, with no time reversal symmetry, the bulk material, no time reversal symmetry breaking effects. You can see that there is each of these quantities, I mean, you can do the same for the Kerr effect, but each of these quantities is a function of both the real and imaginary parts of the conductivity. However, for most materials, unless there is some resonance or absorption edge or something, then K or kappa, which is the imaginary part of the index of refraction, is much, much smaller than N. And therefore, you can see that if K is much smaller than N, then the Faraday angle is basically proportional to the real part of the conductivity, of the diagonal term of the conductivity, and the Kerr effect is the imaginary part of the diagonal term of the conductivity. Okay, and in this limit of very small K, one can use, for example, Kramers-Kronig on the of diagonal terms of the conductivity because of this relation, and people do that. Sorry? Lambda is the wavelength. Mm-hmm. Okay?
A short question.
Yes.
So sigma prime, xy is still in a distributive response, right? Absorptive response,
right? Right. In this language, then sigma xy double prime is the absorptive response, and sigma xy prime is the reactive, if you want. Yeah. So Faraday, for example, if you take the limit of frequency goes to zero, will yield the Hall effect. Okay. That's the limit. So it's basically for very low frequencies. What's going to be written here is some coefficient which takes care of the conductivity times the Hall effect. And if you take the frequency to zero, you simply get the Hall effect. And people use that. Now, just to show you that this is not as simple, if you calculate now, for example, sigma xy double prime, which will yield the Kerr effect, you see that there are lots of contributions. I mean, there is allowed transitions. There is, I mean, that's the asymmetry due to the magnetization. That's kind of what we are searching for, but there are lots of other things. I mean, for example, for those who followed the same field in gallium arsenide, then you know that people use there the wavelengths of 830 nanometers. And the reason is that it coincides with the band edge of gallium arsenide, and you gain in magnitude of the care effect simply because if you want, bend structure effects. Okay, so this also tells you, and this is kind of answering already a question that is, I'm sure, is going to come up later, that it tells you that there is no simple translation from care effect to what is the magnetization in your material. Because bend structure effects and others are going to interfere, and you really need a calibration or somebody that will do the calculation in order to be able to say, I measure a finite care effect, what's the size of the moment? Well, I don't know. We can estimate, but we cannot say precisely like one can in normal magnetic measurements. Okay, and now to close the loop on the connection between magneto-optic and time reversal symmetry, and how do we distinguish now rotation of polarization that is due to time reversal symmetry breaking and one that is due to, say, a birefringence of the system. Any system which is birefringent, if you are not along one of the principal axes, you are going to rotate polarization. If you have chiral molecules, if you go through a sugar solution, for example, you are going to rotate polarization. Cholesteric liquid crystals, if you go through them, will rotate polarization. However, none of these break time reversal symmetry. And the question is, how do you distinguish between these effects and time reversal symmetry breaking effects? And the solution is very simple. So here is a magnetic sample, which we know should break time reversal symmetry. And here is some depolarization that material, which can also rotate polarization, but may not, should not break time reversal symmetry. Both of them rotated the polarization by theta. And the question is, how do we distinguish between the two? And if you remember, we need to take the complex conjugate of the wave, which is taking the wave coming back. And the way to do that, of course, is using a mirror. We reverse the time simply by putting a mirror. And if we put a mirror, we now go back and we see what happens. If we have a material that did not break time reversal symmetry, we come back to where we started. Okay, so this rotation of polarization comes back to nothing. I mean, where we started. However, a material that breaks time reversal symmetry, we come back to where we started, and we now see that we rotated the polarization by an amount of 2 theta. Okay, so if you want, it's like you go with your wave. Let's take just one of the circular polarizations. Take a right circularly polarized light. You go through the material. Okay, you acquire some amount of phase shift because of the difference in index of refraction. You now go to the mirror. You come back the opposite circular polarization. Okay, but remember, if you went in the direction of the magnetization with one particular circular polarization, you come back now with the opposite circular polarization, but against the magnetization. And that's why you acquire twice of the magnitude of the effect. And you can do the same for the left circularly polarized light and then subtract the two to get the Faraday angle. Okay. So first of all, what's the size of the effect in normal systems? That's very important because I told you that you see the results of Kerr or Faraday effects. I cannot tell you what's the size of the moment. So let's see what's a typical size. So strontium ruthenium 03 is a favorite material in our circles at Stanford. So here is a result, and it's also a good material to look at because it's a typical oxide ferromagnet. Okay, it's a ferromagnet below 160 in the bulk and 150 Kelvin in thin films. And you can measure it, and here we measured it down, and you see that already at 90 Kelvin, it is about 2 milliradians. Okay, that's 1,800 microradians. Yes?
You said there's not really a way to get the magnetization out, but how big is the moment in this?
In this material?
Yeah.
About 1 Bohr magneton.
Okay.
Yeah. So then you continue, but of course, this particular measurement was done on a thin film. I mean, don't project from that, because it was done on a thin film. There may be all kind of demagnetization effect. I mean, there are anisotropy effects, etc. So let's just look. I mean, if you cool this material, for example, all the way to 4 degrees, you get about 10 milliradians. If you take manganites and other ferromagnets that we know, which are oxides, you get a very similar result. So transition metal oxides give you about 10 milliradians at low temperatures. Okay. Other materials can give you much higher effect. Iron, for example, give you almost of order of 1 radian at if you measure the rotation. The numbers are actually very large. I should say that at the time when anion superconductivity was proposed, then it was a strong coupling effect, and the proposal was a signal of order of what we see here, order of 10 to 100 milliradians. Okay.
Yeah, so the differences between iron and oxide is likely related to these band security effects.
I mean, spin orbit interactions come in, and if you do a proper calculation for elemental ferromagnets, a lot of work was done by Ed Stern in the 60s, calculating and measuring elemental ferromagnets, and always the size for either Faraday effect, if you take one optical penetration depth, or Kerr effect, is of order of I don't know, a fraction of a radian, 0.2, 0.3 or so. Okay, it's a very, very large effect. Yeah.
So, can this technique detect, for example, fractional vortices if you have a polycrystal or fractional vortices on grain boundaries? Do you have enough sensitivity for that?
Well, we can. I didn't actually tell you anything about the technique yet. All I talked about so far is magneto-optics in general, and what can Kerr or Faraday effects measure. And I told you that magnetic materials have signal of size of the size of a fraction of a radian, or let's say 10 to 100 milliradians, which is a huge signal, and that's why the techniques that people who study magnetic materials use is a very simple technique of simply using cross polarization in order to just to measure the amount of optical rotation. In fact, I got to this field before ITC. I was a postdoc here with Alan Heger, and I measured for the first time when I measured optical rotation was in the lab here on conducting polymers. That's actually why this came up, I started to do optical measurements. Yeah.
I guess I missed one point. What happens if you do a Kerr experiment, so the reflection experiment, on sugar solution?
You see nothing.
You see nothing, right?
I mean, if you do a proper, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, we have a whole list of tests that we did to our apparatus, which I'm going to describe really in 2 seconds because I need to get to results. These included sugar solution, that if you simply measure optical rotation, it's huge.
Sure.
But if you use the apparatus that in principle should eliminate any reciprocal effects that don't break time reverse asymmetry, you see nothing. You see nothing to the sensitivity of the apparatus. And okay, so I'm not going to go through history on how one develops the apparatus, but let me just say that a few years ago in 2006, when it became clear that it's desired to measure a Kerr effect on strontium ruthenate, and at the time there were estimates which were extremely small for the effect. There were estimates. In fact, there was I think a single paper by Yip and Soles that produced something that if you were optimistic, it would be 10 to the minus 10 radians. And I myself did some modification, which I thought is useful, and I managed to get it to 10 to the minus 8. Of course, I did it in order to get a larger number, so I will motivate myself to do the experiment, which we did. However, the whichever method you take to estimate the effect, it was supposed to be extremely small. So you need to have extremely high sensitivity, but at the same time, you need to be able to reject all reciprocal effects. This is something that we learned from ITC. As you know, ITC are extremely birefringent. Take yttrium barium copper oxide, we'll come back to it very soon. It has chains in the plane. It has chains and perpendicular to the chains. That by itself gives you a huge anisotropy of the dielectric function, and you get a huge linear birefringence effect. Now, ITC also have lots of faults when you grow them, stacking faults, etc., and therefore you have effects that are similar to, if you want, cholesteric liquid crystals, in which you kind of have rotation, and therefore this will, like sugar solution, if you want, and you'll have rotation of polarization, which of course don't break time reversal symmetry. All these mean that you really want to be very careful, and as we remember from the early days of a search for anion superconductivity, people did find effects where they were not there, and the effects were all because of the complexity of the material. I'll take that. So we need to reject all reciprocal effects, and of course the best way to reject reciprocal effects is by symmetry, because if you have an apparatus that by symmetry rejects it, then you don't need to worry about subtracting too large numbers, etc., etc. For example, for people who measure Hall effect, you know that to get the Hall effect, you measure with field up, you measure with field down, and you subtract two numbers, and if you have misalignment, you subtract two large numbers to get a very small number. We don't want to do that here. We want to measure the effect and not be bothered with reciprocal effects. Now, we want to measure the absolute value, and we realize that if we want to measure a superconductor, we cannot modulate anything. So that technique, I mean, even for the theorists here, it's understood, right? If you want to measure a particular quantity, then one way, with high sensitivity, one way to do it is to modulate the signal with something. For example, you want to measure the response to magnetic field, you modulate with a small magnetic field, and you lock in to the modulation, and therefore you get out only the signal that is locked onto this particular frequency of the modulation. This allows you to reject other effects. But what are you going to modulate if you are looking for time reversal symmetry breaking effect in strontium ruthenate? I don't know what to modulate. You don't want to apply a magnetic field because then you broke time reversal symmetry. And therefore you want a technique that measures the absolute value without any modulation. Now, all these with these kind of numbers, that's non-trivial.
That's presumably with an optimized frequency. You pointed out that it's very frequency, light frequency dependent.
It may be, and you may not know about that. This is particularly important if you cannot distinguish between reciprocal and non-reciprocal effects. You hit a particular frequency that the reciprocal effects can overwhelm you, and you will not even know about that. Okay, so the way we solved it, and I'm not going to give an instrumentation talk, is by using the so-called Sagnac effect. Sagnac effect is based on the Sagnac loop, which is more than 115 years old, in which you take linearly polarized light through a beam splitter into a loop, which you can create either with mirrors or as we did it with a fiber, and you have now two counter-propagating beams, and it turned that this kind of loop is sensitive to time reversal symmetry breaking effects. For example, if you take the whole loop and you rigidly rotate it, then time reversal symmetry is broken between these clockwise and counterclockwise propagating beams. For example, it takes more time for the beam going clockwise to reach the beam splitter back than the counterclockwise propagating beam, and this difference in time will translate into a phase shift, and this phase shift can allow you to measure the rotation frequency, and it's proportional to the area enclosed by the loop, and therefore therefore people were using this in order to create to make fiber optic gyroscopes, because if it's proportional to the area, you simply make, just like for a solenoid, you make the area many, many times, and you can enhance the signal if you want to measure rigid rotation. Yes?
Where is the sampling there?
There is no sample, because so far it's only to measure rotation.
Okay.
I'm going to skip that. The question which I asked Antoine to ask me, and now I answer it, is, so how can you measure magneto-optics? The question is, you see, before we... the time reverse asymmetry was broken between the two counter-propagating beams, and how do we imitate it now with the magnetic signal? Well, it's very simple. All we need to do is we need to put two perpendicular to each other quarter wave plates. Now, what quarter wave plate does, remember, there is a inside the loop, there is linearly polarized light. So it goes through the quarter wave plate, it becomes circularly polarized, okay? Now it goes through the second quarter wave plate, and it's aligned such that it brings it back to linear polarization. I go now in the opposite direction, I get the opposite circular polarization. And the reason to do that is now I created, if you want, a cavity in which I have two circularly polarized light going against each other. Now, if this was not there and I just simply cut the fiber, I would have the two circular polarization going simultaneously in both directions, and that's not the same as the mirror experiment, because in the mirror experiment things go sequentially, where here things go at the same time, and because they go at the same time, you need to distinguish the two circular polarizations. And the way to do that is use two quarter wave plates which are 90 degrees to each other. If you do that, then if you have a magnetized material, then you see one circular polarization goes against the magnetization, and one goes with the magnetization, but it's the opposite circular polarization, which allows you to get twice the Faraday angle at the detector through some scheme which is really technical, so it doesn't matter. Now, the thing is that with this apparatus in the early 90s, we managed to get about 1 microradian sensitivity and actually show that anion superconductivity is not a good model for high TC. But we never got to the shot noise limit, never got to the high sensitivity that we needed to do Strontium ruthenate. In 2006, when we asked ourselves, well, how can we improve this apparatus and really get to the shot noise limit, the idea was we need to get rid of environmental effects. And the way to get rid of environmental effects is to make every point on the loop equivalent in terms of temperature, in terms of people walking around, in terms of instrumentation that is around, et cetera, et cetera. And the way to do that is, of course, the easiest way is to collapse one side of the loop onto the other and make it a single loop. And this can be done. That's the result, for example, on yttrium barium copper oxide. And this is an apparatus that was calibrated using Earth rotation. And then you see that's 100 microradians, and that's a noise of a couple of microradians. And, of course, to remind you, the prediction for anion superconductivity was many milliradians, okay? Anyway, so the idea is that we want to improve the apparatus, and we notice that there is a line of symmetry. We can collapse now this side of the loop on this side, and the reason you can collapse it is, remember, I have a loop in which I launch linearly polarized light. Now, running in a fiber, it means that I'm using a polarization-maintaining fiber. And in fact, polarization-maintaining fiber is nothing but a birefringent fiber in which I'm going only using one of the axes of the fiber, either the slow or the fast. In fact, all optical communication is using linearly polarized light and using the slow axis. So if you buy a piece of wire from optical communication company, they'll give you a rating for the fiber of so many dBs loss over so many kilometers of the slow axis, and they say nothing about the fast axis. But of course, for a few meters that I need, I don't care if there is loss in the fast axis compared to the slow axis, etc. So I can use both axes. And you can see that if I use both axes, I can collapse this loop here, and I can use now the fiber itself as a loop, although it has zero area. because I can go now with, say, on the slow axis, I can go with one linear polarization. Let's put a mirror instead of a sample. I go through a single quarter wave plate, I have one circular polarization. The mirror brings it back to the opposite circular polarization. Going through the quarter wave plate, I have now the perpendicular linear polarization, which now goes into the fast axis. So I completed the loop with no area. And I can go now in one in the other direction with the fast axis and come back on the slow axis. So the loop is what was clockwise is now fast coming back slow, and what was the counterclockwise is slow coming back fast. So I have now a loop that every point on the loop sees the exact same environment, and that's a loop that has extremely high sensitivity. That's the apparatus. You can see the, I mean, it was described in 2006. Paper, and there are some tricks in order to extract the signal in an interferometric way, which means that you modulate one side over the other. But that's really technicality, just to show you the sensitivity. I can get to short noise. That's the theoretical line that's the detector noise line, that's the theoretical line for short noise, and you see that at a few microwatt, I get to a short noise limit. For example, at 10 microwatt, I'm at a short noise limit of 100 nanoradians per root hertz, which means that if I average over a few minutes, with a power of only 10 microwatt, I get a sensitivity of 10 or so nanoradians. Now, this means that I can now go to very low temperatures, because 10 microwatt is already compatible with dilution refrigerator. And in fact, if I reduce the power, I give up a little bit of sensitivity, but I can go to extremely low temperatures, which was important for Strunz-Butenit. In fact, nobody else can measure this kind of sensitivity at this kind of temperatures. So, here is Strunz-Butenit, the apparatus works. This is now a multi-domain, very thin film of Strunz-Butenit, and you see the full signal all the way to 4 degrees is 6 microradian, and you can really track the transition for these tiny domains. The apparatus works. There were other tests of the apparatus going through biofringent materials, going through normal superconductors, etc. And, of course, all these produce nothing. And the Strunz-Butenit 03 that should produce something does, so it seems to work. So the results on Strunz-Butenit, to remind you, Strunz-Butenit is isostructural to lanthanum barium copper oxide, the first high TC superconductor, except that we have ruthenium oxide layers rather than copper oxide layers. And superconductivity was discovered by the group of Yoshi Maeno. He then perfected the crystals, and TC is now 1.5 degrees. As discovered first, TC was under 1 degree. And we got samples from Yoshi. The proposed order parameter, if I stayed here for Thursday, I would have given a talk that challenged very much this proposal. And you're going to talk about it, right? But this is the proposed, of course, and that's the one that motivated people to search for time reverse asymmetry breaking, is a P plus IP order parameter, complex order parameter, which in which the spin triplet is in the plane, and the angular momentum of plus minus one is pointing out of the plane. So that's the spin triplet in the plane. And of course, this is a chiral order parameter. It has two states, either angular momentum up or down. And of course, such an order parameter is, remind you very much an orbital ferromagnet, right? I mean, you expect that in a single domain material, all the Cooper pair moments will either point up or point down, and you'll have an orbital ferromagnet. However, you cannot really measure it just like you measure a ferromagnet because of the Meissner effect. So you really need to look at defects and edges, etc. And there were measurements. MuSR measurements showed early on that there is a change in relaxation time below 1.5 K, and that's, this was a signature for time reversal symmetry breaking effects, because what muons do is they measure local fields, and there is a new local field found below TC, so this was attributed to time reversal symmetry breaking effects in this system. However, other measurements of edge currents that should appear in a single domain system were not found. These are results of the group of Catherine Moller. So there is still ambiguity about there was ambiguity about time reversal symmetry breaking effects for this material. So we are now adding the Kerr effect, which in principle unambiguously measures an off-diagonal term of the conductivity, and if there is one, then time reversal symmetry is broken, and there is one. That's a resistive transition measurement shows where TC is. It was done not at the same time as the Kerr effect, because if you apply current to measure resistance, you do break time reversal symmetry. And then what we did is we simply cooled the material and we measured the Kerr effect, and we found that there is a finite effect of order of 60 or so nanoradians at the lowest temperature, which was between 0.3 and 0.5 Kelvin. You could train this effect by cooling the system in magnetic field and then turn the field to zero. And just to show you that this is not an effect of vortices, here is the Kerr effect in the presence of the field just before the field was turned on, turned off. And then the field was turned off and nothing changed in the size of the effect. And the size of the effect is the same exactly as was found for zero field cooling. Okay, and you can cool in a negative field, and you can train it negative, and always the same size of the effect as you find in zero field. In zero field, you sometimes find positive, sometimes you find negative, and sometimes you find some things in between. But the maximum zero field is the same as what we find when we train the system. Okay, so it seems to work. These are the conclusions for strontium ruthenate. We did find an effect. We did a thorough study of the temperature dependence near T. And we found it to be linear. We also did a thorough study of the power dependence of the light. For those who worked with superconductors for a long time, you remember there are so-called thermomagnetic effects. You shine light, you can create currents, this can create magnetic field, this will break time reversal symmetry, and you will measure them. So we changed the light by a factor of 10, the power of the light by a factor of 10, and we saw no change in the size of the effect. Changing the light by a factor of 10 would give a huge difference in the Kerr effect. So we really believe it's a genuine effect, and it's a large domain effect because the beam size was large, and for most of the time in zero field, we found the full effect.
I have a question.
Yes.
Why is trapped flux invisible? I mean, it's what you say, right? You just don't pick it up.
Why it isn't, well, we just don't have the sensitivity.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is actually a very good question, and it's a puzzle for me, not with respect to strontium ruthenate, but rather with respect to high TC. Because, so for strontium ruthenate, we did a thorough study in which you study the Kerr effect above the transition, just above the transition. So if the transition is 1.5 K, you study it at around 2 K, okay, as a function of magnetic field. And now you can infer what will be the Kerr effect for so many vortices. So for example, you put 100 Gauss, you know how many vortices there are, you know that at the core of each vortex, you know what is the field. So to within a factor of 2, you should be able to tell what should be the Kerr effect. And this was just another way to, for us, was another way to show that there is no way we can see the effect. Okay. Now, a similar consideration for high TC, for ethylene barium copper oxide, was that if we eliminate any magnetic effects, then we shouldn't have seen vortices. And I'll show you that we see vortices in high TC, and that's, for me, it's a puzzle. But for the strontium ruthenate, I think that we really looked from all possible angles, and the effect is genuine. Okay, so ITC, and I understand that there were talks here for those that were here last week on all these pseudo gap effects, and for those who were not here last week, probably you studied all weekend. So I'll skip this introduction of why we want to study the Kerr effect or time reversal symmetry breaking effects in the pseudo gap and in the superconducting states. That's simply just to remind you that people saw anomalies at a temperature which is much above the transition temperature for underdoped cuprates, which they attributed to something which we call the pseudo gap, a partial gap opening, either in optical measurements or in 1 over T1 NMR measurements, resistive measurements. This was then, let's forget about this piece, but this was then proposed that there is another line, either a crossover line or a phase transition line, we don't know. That line is constructed by putting all these points of this appearance of pseudo gap. There were all kind of possibilities for the pseudo gap, either that it is tangential to the dome of superconductivity, or it cuts through the dome of superconductivity, or simply ends at the dome of superconductivity, and different theories that attribute different properties to this pseudo gap will end up with different phase diagram. The thing that got me to revisit ITC was in fact this loop ordering system, and in particular the one that was proposed by Chandra Varma, which is a loop ordering system we'll hear about in the next talk, that does not break translational symmetry. So there are current loops within a unit cell that average to zero in a unit cell, and translational symmetry is not broken, unlike, for example, this DDW proposal. So, and then experimentally, there was first an experiment which subsequently was retracted by the authors, explaining it in a different method, a different way by the group of Jeff Sonier, saw a change in relaxation and therefore proposed time reversal symmetry breaking effects below. This is 6.67 doping, that's about 1/8 for the YBCO, and it's about 160 or so Kelvin below which there was a change in relaxation. And inside the dome, optimally doped at 6.95, below 45 degrees. Later they proposed that these two, not these two, but rather this one, and by inference also this one, are a consequence of some structural effect, okay? I'll come back to it. Later, and that's kind of what I think restarted the whole discussion, were the measurements of Philippe Bourges, in which they looked at the difference between spin flip and non-spin flip scattering as a function of doping in the underdoped regime, and found that this difference, when normalized properly, and that's an issue by itself, showed a transition or a place below which there is a development of some long-range order, which in fact that's the long-range order if we consider current loops, and you can mimic it with spins. If you put spins, these are the couples, so these are the oxygens. If you put spins on the oxygens in this way, that's how you will arrange them. Now, this in fact motivated me to revisit the ITC, because you notice that the antiferromagnetic coupling here, okay, is on non-equivalent bonds. And although in a situation like that, you expect to have a zero effect if you measure Kerr effect, because you measure with a beam size of a few microns, and that's a unit cell of size of a few angstroms, a simple consideration, I said, look, this is the model system, okay, so these two moments are the same, okay, so the total magnetization is zero. However, we remember that there is an autohomic distortion, and I need to cancel this one against this one, but they are on inequivalent bonds, and therefore maybe there is a net moment. Okay, So here is the kind of the cartoon of that. In fact, from the point of view of moment, my estimate was, look, they proposed a moment of order of 0.05 to point, I think 0.05 up to 0.1 Bohr magnetons. If I multiply it by the orthorhombic distortion, I get something which is reduced by a factor of 100. So, okay, 10 to the minus 4. 10 to the minus 4 in a normal oxide should be very, very easy for me to measure. So I said, okay, let's measure that. Okay, so let's skip that and just get... So for those who saw the talk, part of this talk before, there were much less points than we have now. These are points in which we measure. Red are single crystals, blue are thin films, here is, if you want, an anatomy of a data set. Okay, that's at 6.67. We started with this one because of the MuSR measurements of Jeff Sonier that were at that composition. This is where it is on the phase diagram of YBCO. And these two, this line and this line, the Nayel and superconducting dome, were determined for these samples, which are the UBC samples, by the group of Doug Bone. So we are measuring the same samples on that phase diagram. High quality sample, very small. In fact, the spec, I mean, the sample is a third of a millimeter by a third of a millimeter by less than 100 micron thick. Okay, so it's a tiny sample, but at the same time supposed to be extremely high quality. They oxygen anneal it in order to align to order the oxygens. It's an ortho 8, so there is a particular ordering of the oxygens, and now we measure it. So let me go through some cycles of the measurement. First of all, if you now cool the sample at very high field, and that's a few tesla. And now you turn the field to zero, okay? You see that there is a huge effect at low temperatures, okay? That's 4 degrees, okay? That's a huge effect, okay? Now, this effect looks like it decays exponentially down to Tc, and then there is some remnant. If you want, we understand this as response of trapped vortices. Since we apply such high field, a few tesla, there are lots of vortices around. I mean, 6.67 is fairly good pinning, has fairly good pinning strengths. So you get a signal of order of about, 9 microradians. Okay, and that signal, as I said, decays exponentially. But then above Tc, something is left. Something is left of order of, about a half of microradian, and disappears at another temperature, which I call Ts, okay? So you say, here is a blow up of that, okay? That's where the exponential, that's Tc, and then something is left, and then nothing. All the way from 150 or so up to room temperature, nothing is there. If you cannot see the numbers, this is 0.2, microradian. That's 200 nanoradians. Okay. All right.
This is sort of your ultimate resolution.
No. You can get much better, but there was no need for that. Also, everything is also set by the full resolution, and here it kind of gets spoiled by that loud signal. Okay, so what you do is say, okay, I'm not gonna cool at few tesla. I'm gonna cool only at 60 Gauss. You cool at 60 Gauss, and then you turn the field off, and you see that there is still a little bit of something, which disappears at Tc, or at least that's how we interpret it. Okay, you say, okay, maybe there are still vortices, although 60 Gauss is a tiny field, for that. Remember that 60 Gauss for strontium ruthenate, we couldn't see anything. But here we can see something, as if there is kind of something that enhances the signal. And then again, it disappears at 150 degrees. So you say, okay, let's put it in a double mu metal shielded. The field inside is less than 3 milligauss. Okay, so in terms of trapped vortices, well, maybe I have in the size of the beam 1 or 2. Okay, and that's it. Now you don't see anything, and the same transition. Okay, so there is a signal. It's there. Disappears at 150 for this particular sample. Here's another sample, that's the author 2. It's a very popular sample. Lots of debates have been, we witnessed a lot of debates on samples of that composition. It's an author 2, oxygen ordered. Again, tiny sample, Duker effect, sharp transition. This is where it is now. And what you see is that, again, you cool it in a large field, 5 Tesla. Now, for this, 6.5 is very anisotropic. Pinning is extremely weak. So you cool it at 5 Tesla, this is 1.4 microradian. Remember, I cooled the 6.67, it had, in high field, it had 9 microradian. Now it's only 1.4 microradian, and then I warm it up. Here is TC, so you see this excess signal is now gone, and I still have something that disappears now at about 210 degrees, not 150.
So any correlation of that TS with anomalous Nernst effect or features?
Well, I can say something about the Nernst effect, but no. I mean, these are not the same temperatures. I mean, if at all, this is very close to T star.
This is higher, right?
Sorry?
This is definitely higher.
Oh, yeah, much higher, yeah. So again, you put it in a double mu metal shield, etc. And you cool it down at really zero field, and you warm it up, and that's what you get. And you get here 0.8 microradian. You see, which is exactly what you'll get if you kind of smooth this curve. So this excess is therefore the vortex excess because you cooled in very large field, and that's at low field you get that. And temperature is.
Those arrows mean that's reversible.
This one?
Yeah.
I mean, you can go up and down now. It's going to stay the same. So now let's go inside the dome. Okay? So that's 6.92, which is slightly overdoped. It's TC is 91.7, as measured by SQUID. Let me again show you, go through this the measurement. So first, if I cool at very high field, now because optimal doping, if you remember, is extremely strong pinning material, I trap a lot of vortices. So now the signal here is 35 microradians. You see how in the 6.5 it was 1.4 microradian, in the 6.67 it was 9 microradian, and now it's 35 microradian, very strong pinning, so a lot of remnant magnetization in the system after I turn the field to zero. And again, this is TC. Now I want to point out the following. Now blow up just this piece, and you see that I go and how this is TC, and unlike the previous samples I showed you, in which there was something remnant that disappeared at higher temperature, this is TC, okay? I mean, if you look just along TC, this is plus 100 nanoradian, minus 100 nanoradian, okay? It looks like there is nothing. On the way, by the way, there was something here at around 50 degrees, 55 degrees, as we cool the sample. That's a pronounced reproducible bump, which we didn't know what it, I mean, that's of course in the superconducting state, we didn't know what it is. But what we saw is that, well, first, again, you cool it at zero field, that's double mu metal shield, you warm it up, and what you see is that it is true that the signal is very small. I mean, this is 100 nanoradians. Remember, before, everything was between plus minus 200 nanoradians. This is 100. This is 50 nanoradians. Okay? So that's an extremely small signal. But I think that you'll agree with me that below a certain point, all the points are up. If you do it with a negative field, all the points are down. Now, I cannot determine exactly where is the temperature, but it should be in this vicinity. So in the absence of any other idea, we said, hey, maybe these two are correlated. And the temperature we determined is about 55 degrees, which in fact coincides with the, I mean, so that's this temperature. This is TC, okay?
Now, here we hit the resolution. I cannot quite get it.
Well, here I hit, yes, yeah, for this measure. The reason, by the way, is that, I mean, in Sonsovutene I can do better, because there I measure over a very small temperature window. I measure between 0.3 Kelvin and, let's say, 2 Kelvin. It's very easy to control temperature at low temperatures. It is very difficult to have a temperature span from 4 degrees to room temperature. Very difficult.
But he certainly has enough resolution to say that there is a transition.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's clear that below a certain point, all the points are up.
Makes a bit think of the typical neutron plots, right?
Well, neutron data is that's... Okay. So there are other systems. Here is a 0.75, and the transition now it's at 120, which I just want to contrast it with what was measured in 1990, where the wiggles here were 2 microradians. Now we are measuring at the 50 nanoradians sensitivity. Here, again, these results, you can put the results on the on a plot. But before that, I want to show now more results and new results on films. I find, hi. I find these results on films. Should I go to one? I find these results on films extremely important, because for those who do films, you know, films are disordered. Films, although people use the word epitaxy, it only means that you can distinguish layers. There are grain boundaries, there are faults, there are all kind of stuff in the films. And there is, of course, interface with the substrate. There are lots of effects that are disorder, and therefore you expect that if there is anything that has to do with disorder, let's say in the single crystals or any kind of weird phase or something, then it's going to be, I mean, if it's a weird phase, it's going to be enhanced in films, and if it's something that is reduced because of disorder, then it should disappear completely in films. Okay? So these are films that partly were made at Stanford and some, which I forgot which, were made at Tel Aviv University by the group of Guy Deutscher. Here's a transition. Again, you see, this is a film. It's no longer a transition which is 1 degree sharp. Here's a typical film after annealing, just to show you that the transition goes from, that's 60 to 40. Yeah, it's difficult to see. So this is 40 degrees, and this is 60 degrees. Okay, very wide transition. Okay, just blowing up the transition region. Well, let's start with some results. Let's take a film which is near optimal dope, but slightly under dope. TC is 89, and you cool it in 60 Gauss, turn the field to zero, and you measure. Okay, this is the result. Now, if you look at the transition, which again I apologize, the transition starts actually for that one it's a pristine film, so the transition is rather sharp, 89, and what you see is that, you know, there is something there, and it's around here, it's around 100 degrees, 89. Okay, it's definitely not there at 150 degrees. And it's not there here, it's some, okay, and it's a relatively sharp transition. And the interesting thing is that, you see, it ends up with a size of an effect that is not different than what we saw in the crystals. Okay, that's outside the dome. Here's another film, PC75. Now it's underdoped, you see that there is a transition. Now it's actually closer to, I don't know, somewhere here, 150, 130. Okay, and again, look, it's the same size of the effect that we got on the crystals, of same doping. And well, here is another one. That's one very close to 6.67, and you see that well, there is maybe something at higher temperatures, but really the major transition occurs here at 160 degrees, and it gets to 700 nanoradians, to within 15%. That's what we got for the single crystals. For me, it's extremely peculiar and really show the how genuine is this effect. So if I put now all the samples, films, squares, and single crystals, that's what I get. The dashed line is guide to the eye. It's not anything else. So these results suggest that there is a phase transition there. Now, I don't have time anymore, which is really, you know, Doug talked at the beginning, gave all kind of what's happening next week, and took a lot of my time, but I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining. So I'm not going to go into more details. I'm going to stop in a minute. I'm going to stop here, but I want to mention that first, films and crystals are on the same line, and it suggests that there is a phase transition effect. If you take now the mu SR data, these are the two mu SR data. Well, seem to be on the same line, okay? And if you now take the neutron data, these are the neutron data on YBCO, okay? Now, they are removed from that line or that bunching. However, neutron is done on large crystal or collection of crystals. I have no guarantee on the actual composition and what one does. In fact, a few weeks ago in Cargés, I suggested to Philippe and Bourge, and we are probably going to do it, take the neutron crystals on which these measurements were done, and we will do Kerr effect. And we can do Kerr effect on different parts of the crystal, and we can determine the temperature at different parts of the crystals. And I think this is going to resolve that issue of whether this is the same thing that we see or not. There is an unusual hysteretic effect, which I didn't have time to talk about, and I don't have time to talk about, so I'm not going to talk about it. I just want to get to the point in which if you take all that into account, you get to a conclusion that there is a phase transition, but this is what I wanted to get at. Now, we measure a finite Kerr effect below a certain temperature, which could come because of some magnetic ordering, because, let's say, the Philippe Bourge measurement. But you can also think of a different scenario in which there is some magnetic stuff that either produces nothing or an extremely small effect that is immeasurable by us. And then there is a phase transition at T star. And that phase transition now does something to the magnetic stuff and therefore allow us to measure. In that respect, what we measure is not the is not the direct order parameter, but we measure the phase transition through coupling to that order parameter. I cannot rule out this possibility. And one of the reasons that I like this possibility is which I didn't have time to talk about, I'll just say in one word, in one sentence, there are the measurements of the group of Bernard Keimer at 6.45. That's very close to 6.5. And there are recent, all I know is that some attempts to measure that ordering in 6.45 failed, and that Keimer measures strikes at 6.45. Stripes are not different than a structural distortion, okay? So it could very well be that there is a link between the two, in which there is some magnetic stuff that is squished by structural distortion, which also goes along the lines of some of the results of the more recent results of MIRSR, in which they try to identify these positions as a structural phase transition. And what we see is really the consequence in whatever magnetic stuff there is there by seeing a finite effect. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
So we have time for a few questions while Terry plugs in. Okay.
So what can you tell us about the size of the magnetic moment?
Okay, in the introduction I said that I don't, this is something very difficult. However, I can.
We can be switching while you answer.
Yes. So, in a simple estimate, simply by saying it is a transition metal oxide, I know what's the size of Kerr effect that I measure, what will be the equivalent magnetic moment? 10 to the minus 5 Bohr magnetons.
And so you explained before that if I take Philippe Bohr signal and multiply by the atomicity, I expect something...
10 to the minus 4, so,
That's assuming that it was ordered moments on oxygens, not currents.
I understand.
Right. Right.
I'm just trying to understand whether this is at least roughly consistent. Or.
I have a feeling that you've answered this question before, but it occurred to me during your talk. Can you measure the signal in the magnetic field, or does that...
Okay. The signal in... in principle, I can measure signal in magnetic field. The problem is that right now the apparatus works best if that magnetic field is not larger than about 100, maybe 200 Gauss. And the reason is that a piece of the fiber that is gets very close to the sample is in the magnet, in the solenoid. So when I try to do large fields, it has its own father effect. Now, it's true, it's extremely small, and it's a second order effect because of the two counterpropagating beams. The first order is canceled, but it has 10 centimeters of fiber inside. So there is a tiny effect that we need to cancel, and I don't like to cancel too much, to subtract numbers. So, right now we are limited to just one more test.
Just what I'm wondering is, one of the things you commented is that the vortex signal seems to be anomalously large.
Right.
And maybe it's not a vortex signal, but a magnetic field signal.
Yeah, if there is, if I went through this anomalous magnetic response, I would come to that conclusion that I believe that there is some magnetic thing there that gives me the signal.
Right, so one could check that by looking at the magnetic field dependence of the signal at temperatures above TC but right. Below T.
Yeah. Aaron's going to be here this afternoon, so look for him to continue some of the discussion. And now, Terry, we go on with the...